You're listening to In the Event We Don't Make It with Tori and Amjad.
I'm Tori Stapleton.
And I'm Amjad Osman.
And this is In the Event We Don't Make It.
If you come across these files,
this is what was going on during the coronavirus 2020.
So make sure to tune in to see exactly what was happening.
Or don't.
Let's jump in. All right.
Yeah.
Today is April 2nd. We decided not to record on April Fool's Day, which I think is kind of funny.
Yeah, man. Wasn't shit funny, bro.
Yeah, there wasn't
anything funny. That's why.
Yeah.
I had nothing for you.
I think if people have noticed, we've been taking our time to make sure we give ourselves the time to really, take everything in.
Right.
Because it's hitting both of us in different ways, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But
it's real, man. It's real.
It's getting crazy. I think the world today just crossed over the 1 millionth person infected mark. And so, you know, this is a really, really difficult situation for all of us to be in. But I'm glad that you and me get a chance to talk to someone today that has nothing to do with the coronavirus or anything.
Right. A nice, pleasant break from, everything we're hearing on a daily basis. So,
absolutely.
It's beautiful. Yep.
You and me had a chance yesterday to watch The Scheme on HBO. The Scheme is a new documentary that is centered around a pay-for-play investigation, that unfolded over, I want to say, a span of a year and a half, about an 18-month period.
Yeah, it was a couple years, almost, yeah.
That actually involved some of the top basketball coaches in the country, college basketball coaches, who were basically, or allegedly, I should say, funneling money to players to get them to be part of their basketball programs.
Yeah.
it's kind of crazy to think about that. You played basketball in college.
Yeah.
Would you ever accepted a few bucks here and there?
I can't say I wouldn't have, but it was something that I saw coming up. I mean, I came up around a lot of top prospects. So, and on the AAU scene, a lot of my friends were, receiving benefits, and it was just what I thought was normal. You know what I mean? So it's not something that I ever saw was necessarily wrong. It was just kind of like the way things were. So I think for a lot of people who don't have people who are highly touted or aren't close to college coaches or college programs, they wouldn't really understand or they wouldn't really know. But I think anybody who's kind of come up through the circuit has definitely seen players receiving benefits, and it's somewhat normal.
It's been a major topic in the world for quite some time, in the world of sports as well as in the world in general. Players have been fighting for their right to be paid as collegiate athletes,
right,
anyway. And so I think that there's a lot for us to discuss here.
For sure.
Obviously, we'll let Christian Dawkins, our guest for today, really dive in with us and help us understand exactly what he went through as well as the entire situation around how he basically was set up by the FBI.
Right. Entrapment at its finest, man. The documentary was amazing. Anybody who hasn't seen it, go check it out. But I'm really excited to talk to this young brother right here, man.
Same here. Same here. So let's give our man a call and see.
Let's do it.
Let's see if we can get him on the line. Christian, how you doing? This is Amjad.
How are you, boss? My bad for being late. I was backed up. I'm sorry. I apologize.
It's all good, man.
Brother.
We're happy to have you with us, man. I got my man Tori with me here as well.
Christian, what's up, brother?
How are you today, boss?
I'm good, man. I'm really excited to rap with you, brother. We watched the documentary last night, man, and we're super intrigued.
What did you guys think of it?
Oh, man, it was extremely well done. Extremely well done. I told Tori, I said, you remind me a lot of myself. I'm a little bit younger than you, but you remind me a lot of myself. And I just sat here watching you talk about all your interests and the things that you love to do and the fact that you just never let anything stop you. And I was inspired. So to see everything else unfold after that, I was like, oh, no, we got to tell this man's story.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
I definitely appreciate it for sure.
No, same here, man. I in a lot of different ways, I saw a lot of myself as well, just, being so close to the basketball community and having a lot of friends and connections within the game, within the sport. It's just amazing, bro, what you were able to accomplish. And, I was just truly inspired as well. and truly intrigued. As somebody,
yeah,
I played college basketball on a Division II level, and I was telling Amjad a little earlier that, you know, I had a lot of friends coming up who were highly touted, you know, who went through the AAU circuit and, you know, had every college in America after them, and, you know, receiving benefits was just something that was just a part of the game. You know what I mean? It was just something that was normal. So I never saw anything wrong with it. It was like, man, this is what everybody does. This is kind of like, this is, you know, it's another day.
Yeah.
Tuesday, as I say. It's just Tuesday.
Yeah, exactly, man. Exactly. It's just another day, another package dropped off, another bag left right on a corner.
So Christian, you know, we appreciate you making the time to chat with us. A big part of this is pay for play. Obviously, we want to address some of the other things that happened in terms of social injustice when it comes to the government being involved. Help our listeners understand, what exactly does pay for play mean?
I mean, the idea of pay for play, the wording, I would assume, probably came from the NCAA, and you use it as a definition for any individual, whether that's a coach, an agent, a financial advisor, a booster, whomever, that pays the student athlete. Now, it's a little bit tricky because technically I'm not, or a marketing person or anybody outside of a university official isn't paying the athlete to play per se.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm saying it's probably an NCAA thing. The idea that athletes, or the story that athletes are getting compensation not in the open does happen. Obviously, I think the documentary shows that. But for myself, and I want to say, most people that does represent talent, 99% of them would agree with me that the players should be paid. Mm-hmm. So in our head, my head, and other people like myself, none of us are looking at this as if it's a bad thing or as if it's something that shouldn't be happening. Because, listen, a lot of people also represent coaches and athletic directors, and they get paid a lot of money.
Right.
You know, take commissions from those things, and it's completely above board. It's just that the players on their team, we couldn't do the same. Thank you. We couldn't do the same exact thing. So pay for play is essentially the idea that it's something wrong with being paid to play. That's why you have the term. And that idea came from the NCAA. And essentially it's just, you know, anybody who outside of a family member who provides any kind of compensation to an athlete or an extra benefit. It could be, you guys have to understand this. If you criminalize NCAA rules, someone could also help an athlete with his tutoring that isn't a university official. He could help him with his homework or help her with his homework,
right,
or that's an outside tutor. You could also be charged with wire fraud now, because that's added benefit outside of you know, their scholarship.
Right.
So anything that's not the scholarship or the school providing, and is seen as, you know, devilish behavior in the eyes of the NCAA, because they're essentially just the middleman. You know,
right,
everyone wants to paint us to be the middleman, but technically all they are is the middleman between brands, consumers, and the general public and the athletes, and they take the money and keep it as opposed to sharing it with their talent. So that's a long-winded explanation of what exactly pay-for-play means and everything like that.
That makes a lot of sense, but I want to take a step back, right? Because there's a lot of people that don't understand why players need to be paid to begin with. I grew up from very humble beginnings, and so did Tori, and I imagine you did as well. And so going to school and having mommy and daddy fund my education was not an option for me. I didn't have anybody to pay for me. And so are these kids in the same situation, or why exactly are they taking handouts in the first place?
Well, listen, I'll answer your question simply, as opposed to giving you a theory of mine. I'll just answer it like this. This is America. If you're great at something, you get paid for it. That's the end of the story.
Straight like that.
This is the thing. If any other industry, this would be like like Jeff Bezos, I've seen recently with the COVID thing, wasn't paying his employees a certain number, or he made them do overtime, whatever. Basically, it was a national story and problem. NCAA does that time 50, the stuff that they do to student athletes, and no one says anything. So this idea that of anyone who asks the question of why they should be paid or why is someone, whatever, participating in revenue that is derived from athletes, I would just respond to that question, well, why do you get paid to teach, or why do you get paid to be an accountant or any profession? Like, it's not that difficult. This is
No, it's not.
Stuff, you know what I mean?
It's the right thing to do.
And then that's what raises the question of the demographic of people who they're questioning. Correct. And it's traditionally it's young African American, you know, males and females, you know? And you understand why. It's like people aren't stupid. All of a sudden they get dumb when we start asking these valid questions, you know? People are too smart to be dumb. You know?
Correct. And I think that in 2020 the access to information is much higher than it was in 1970 or 50s, whenever these moves came around. So you have a different interpretation of everything, especially as the years go by. I mean, there's 10-year-olds or 12-year-olds that I meet that are way more advanced than I was when I was 10 or 12. So you have people who know more, mixed with the scenario that the people that are in power want people like myself or African-American talented people to feel bad about asking what they're worth, or feel bad about eating what they're worth, or they want us to feel like we're giving you this, so you should be happy. We're giving you a scholarship, we should be happy.
Right.
When in reality, it's like, dude, if Coach K, God bless the man, one of the best of all time, if he wants to go to Marist tomorrow, and make more money, no one's going to say Coach K is corrupt. No one's going to say the people who negotiated his deal is corrupt. No one's going to say Marist corrupt for trying to get him. It's wow. This is an unbelievable thing that has happened. Coach K is going to Marist. Everyone's celebrating. That's what happens when there is a powerful white person in that position.
Right. You
have an African-American player who has no representation, has no body speaking on his, or advocating on his behalf, and he may not really know the marketplace. If he wants to transfer, or if he wants to up his economic, or receive his economic value, he's called corrupt, his family's called corrupt, again, they try to make it out for a year when they transfer. There's so many other things. It's basically, you know, you're restricted by, that just aren't happening for people who don't look like me. One of the reasons why I'm so passionate about it, because it's like, listen, I understand the bigger play. I understand the moves. What's happening to us, we're getting bamboozled. Like, the greatest trick that's ever been played in business is what the NCAA has done to the general public by drilling this concept of amateurism and this holier than thou, and trying to connect that with education, even though none of this is about education.
Nope.
Not at all.
Has made everyone feel like, oh, they shouldn't be getting this because they're getting books and pencils and notebooks. Like, this sounds ridiculous. This literally sounds ridiculous. And at the end of the day, you don't know when an athlete's value has reached its end. And that's the reason why the players should. I'll give you guys a better example. My last year doing, before I got arrested in the draft, there was a player that I represented that was a top 20 pick. I was doing his shoe deal with Adidas. He got offered no money because as a 20th pick or whatever he got picked at, to a team, you're probably going to be on the bench as a rookie in the first couple years. He got offered no money by Adidas with the same people that I got $100,000 from, or got, you know, the $100,000 commitment from for Brian Bowen to go to Louisville. Now, if you look at the two players, you may say, well, that NBA draft pick is better than this college player. Why would Adidas pay this college player $100,000? It makes no common sense.
Right.
You don't understand the bigger play.
Mm-hmm.
That rookie in NBA is not worth to Adidas what he's worth, what Brian Bowen is worth if he went to Louisville. You know what I'm saying? So you have to look at everybody's situation, and you have to maximize every situation on an individualized basis. Because Christian Dawkins, just using that example, may not be the best soccer player in the world, but if I'm the best player on LA Galaxy, I should be paid like the best player.
Right, exactly.
On the best team.
It's about visibility.
That's what it is.
Exactly. It's about visibility.
You know what I'm saying? So is visibility and also your value to the particular person that you're negotiating with.
Exactly.
Business isn't about what you're worth or what you should be. It's about what you negotiate and what you take. So, or what you're able to get the other party to give you. I should say take. That sounds a little bit rough.
No, no, it's real. It's real.
That's basically the way I look at it, and the way I want everybody to look at it. I hope and pray that the athletes understand their value and what they bring to the table, because if they do, all these things change overnight. And the way I look at it, and you touched on it a little bit, is, listen, I came from a two-parent home. My mom and dad had decent jobs, made good money. But when it came time for me to go to school, I paid for myself, and obviously, as you see in the doc, I ended up dropping out. But my sister went to Spelman, and we all had to pitch in to make sure to get through and graduate. So
right.
Basically, my point is, I didn't grow up even in a good situation. I didn't grow up in a situation where we just had endless amounts of capital resources. So I'm almost sure most of the people that are like me are probably similar dynamic or even worse in some instances. So the way I look at it is, yo, that's $1 billion that the NCAA is getting that could be going back into our neighborhoods, into our communities, into our schools, because most of the athletes that are going to be receiving that income, if it's opened up or if players can monetize, is going to be African American. So I look at it more so as a bigger issue at stake here. We're fighting for resources. We're fighting for what should be ours, and that's the only real way to have people change, bring power back into our communities. We've got to have the economic independence that we don't have to go to somebody and ask them for what we should be getting. We're partners, or at best, we're partners at worst, or at best, we own it outright, where we're dictating what the scenarios will be as it pertains to the economics. So for me, it's a much bigger thing that's happening. It's not just, these guys, you know, got into this a shitty situation with the FBI. The scheme isn't a sports film. It's a criminal justice,
right,
social justice film. It's a much bigger story at play here, and I think that's the reason why it's resonated so much with viewers. People see it and want to watch it again. People see it and want to tell somebody, because it makes you feel something.
Exactly.
It makes you, when you see it, and you see its absurdity to it, it upsets people, or it makes you emotional, or it makes you want to be a, you know, root for people, whatever. It makes you feel. And that was the purpose of the piece, is to create a story and to create content that would show some of the bigger issues at play in American society today. And I think we accomplished that, and I would hope everybody continues to keep that in mind as hopefully change is made and reform is made, the overall system and bigger problems that are happening.
No, I definitely think that you did a great job of accomplishing that. You know, I definitely felt something as somebody who came out of high school, was a Division I prospect, who ended up blowing out my knee in front of 250 college coaches in a live tournament in AAU. I recognized how disposable we are, you know, how, you know, when everything is good, you're healthy, you're playing well, you know, you got these scholarships on the line. And then the second, you know, you're seen as a wounded horse, it's like, well, good luck with everything. Those conversations mm-hmm. changed. Those conversations for me changed overnight. So if the NCAA, if the NCAA claims to be all about, you know, education and helping people with higher education, it's like, you got to understand this other side. Is that if I can't do for you, I'm not worth anything. And you know, suddenly those scholarships I was offered were thrown out the window. You know, I ended up going and playing Division II level, you know, on a full scholarship. But you know, we gotta really understand here that the NCAA knows exactly what we are. We're workhorses. You know what I mean? To help them get money. And you know, you guys have exposed that. You know, and just like you, I came from a two parent home. You know, my parents had decent jobs. But they weren't in a position to pay for me to go to college. So like you said, coming from a situation that wasn't bad at all, you know, in comparison to a lot of these other guys coming from the inner cities, it's like, if it was tough for us, imagine for these other guys. So I felt it. I mean, I'm watching the documentary, and I felt every part of it, you know. Mm-hmm. So I just thank you. No, I thank you.
Christian, I think you did a really great job of talking about building those relationships and getting people to understand the value that was behind having a really intimate, close relationship with somebody, right? It's different, right? Like, if I fuck with you, I can respect you, and I'm going to do whatever I can to really support you when it comes time for it. You talked about that Adidas deal. Now, I want to, in that same vein, I want to talk about your relationship with Jill Bailey and Jeff D'Angelo, and I want to kind of dig into the injustice you felt in terms of having the FBI set you up, or feeling like they set you up. Can you talk to us a little about what that experience was like?
I mean, listen, it's a shit show. You know, it feels like it's hard to really put into words, to be completely honest with you, because it's a lot of different emotions. You have shock, you have, you know, you're upset, you have sadness, you feel stupid, you're embarrassed. I mean, it's every negative emotion you can feel is probably what I felt when I discovered that they were FBI agents, because I genuinely went into this thinking that they're real partners. Like, the agreement that it shows that I signed, and obviously for the sake of time, we couldn't get to everything.
Right.
But like, dude, like, lawyers looked over that. Like people that I was, you know, the last at ASM, the company that I was at, every principal there looked over that agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Outside counsel. We all vetted it as much as possible and tried to prevent anything from happening. You're going to remember, I was just coming off the Uber incident.
That's right.
So everybody was heightened. The, you know, everybody's attention to detail was heightened after that. So for them to, I'm going into this thinking they're my partners, and even with in the film, you see, I'm saying, okay, you know, I was taking the money, but if you see, I took the money, put it back into the bank account, which with the business bank account sits in my head, I'm like, yo, keeping this money, saving it for the families and the players. Now, their idea was completely different. I didn't know what was happening until I got arrested.
Mm.
It was definitely, I feel like, unfair. Will I say that I'm the, that I have, will I say that I can legitimately argue that I did nothing that was unethical or close to the gray area? No, I mean, there was definitely some stuff I did that probably I could have just, instead of me trying to do it that way, I could have just tried to start a whatever movement and just get the rules changed. There's ways that I could have used my intellect mm-hmm. and my talent to not get in this situation. So I'm not going to blame 100% on the FBI and the DOJ for what they did, but I would probably blame 80%.
Right.
They didn't have to charge. You didn't even have to come to us with this dumb shit. You didn't just, because this is the thing I almost got in tears about the other day watching the film. And obviously you take it in differently than me.
Mm-hmm.
I take it in the film like, okay, this is FBI evidence that's in this film. This isn't my story, and I'm just up here talking shit. The fact that they heard those wiretaps between me and the undercover agent, and I'm literally telling him I don't want to do what they think is the crime. How did they not say we ain't gonna keep fucking with this person?
Yo, that's like, the part that hit me. That's the part that hit me so hard when I'm watching it.
You know, I went
and I'm like, he is literally saying I don't want any parts of this. This is stupid. And then even when you got on the phone with Murrow. And you say again, like, yo, they want to do this dumb shit. I don't agree with it. It's like time and time again, you knew that whatever they were trying to do wasn't the right way to go about doing things.
It wasn't about you. But it wasn't about you. I think the FBI's plot was to use you as a pawn in a bigger scheme, right? Because for you.
You know, they definitely thought I was going to just snitch on everybody, 100%.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely what they expected, right? Somebody was going to go down one way or another. It just happened to be you, but they used you to bring in everybody else. If you look at the cartels, right? You talked about El Chapo, right? El Chapo, if you're listening, we ain't got no beef.
Yeah, I love that part too.
Exactly.
I want no problems.
You always use that disclaimer.
That's right. That's right.
I don't know if it's him or not, but I've seen people saying that they have chopped people's heads off. So I'm
cool. Right, right, right. No smoke. We want no smoke with El Chop. Yeah,
we want no part of that. But the same way they did him, right, and used him to capture his entire supply and distribution, right, they used it to knock down a whole bunch of other people. It seemed that they were trying to do the same thing to you. I don't know if it's just me sitting here watching. I said to Tory when I saw it, I said, yo, they just fucking set him up.
Oh yeah, straight entrapment. But this goes back to what we're talking about in the first place, about how they're using the culture, the African-American culture, to benefit them. So it's like it all goes back to the same thing we're talking about in the first place. You know what I mean? And it's wild. It's like, bro, this is what they do.
So Christian, I know you don't have a lot of time left. So before you go, I want to know what's next for you in terms of this investigation. I know that you've appealed. Talk to us. What's next for you?
The appeal. So basically, the lawyers filed an appeal. The lawyers filed briefs. We did an oral argument for the first appeal maybe a couple weeks ago. You can look up some of the reports out of it. It looked like it was 50-50. Mm-hmm. It seemed like some of the judges were like, yo, really? They defrauded Louisville? Seriously? And it seemed like another judge was like, maybe they did. So I don't really know what will happen. That will be up to the judge's discretion. I hope and pray that they understand and see every angle of the scenario. And this is in everyone's defense, man. This is a very, very, very new theory. This isn't something that gets tried repeatedly, like a drug case or something like that. So everybody's kind of going through this for the first time. Especially in the Southern District of New York. So all these judges, the prosecution, everybody is doing this for the first time. There's a lot of things that have to get worked out the first time to anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope the appeal process can sell out some of these things, and we figure out a way that we can move forward and create real change. So I don't know what will end up happening. I just literally can only just, I'm at the mercy of the court system and to see what will end up being the final result. That could be tomorrow. It could be a year from now.
Right.
I really have no idea.
And what are your goals? What are you hoping to walk away from this having accomplished? Just like you at one point wanted to have your own sports agency. And obviously you were able to do that. And clearly you've been able to do anything that you've set your mind to. What do you hope to walk away from this? What change do you hope to see?
I mean, from a business perspective, my company, Gallagher Brown's the operating company, and these things haven't been announced, but they will soon. So Gallagher Brown owns Chosen Music, which is my label venture at Atlantic. My partner, Alex Rifkin, we have a joint venture label there. We also have a management company where we manage, talent under that umbrella, and also a publishing company, which is publishing in music is essentially, a record deal for a songwriter or a producer. And also nice. for artists, I mean, because they're technically songwriters in some cases. So that's the asset, this is what I will call it, the record company, publishing company. And then I also have under that the DVM film company, which obviously, you know, the theme was the first project. There's been, since the theme has been released, I mean, everybody that you can think of has reached out to try to do film adaptions to the scheme. There's a TV series deal that I made, scripted, that I can't announce yet, but like it's some stuff that's coming through there. And then from the sports side, the biggest thing for me, like, is if I wanted to represent players tomorrow, I could. Number one thing I want to do before that is to focus is get these rules changed. Like, I want to do everything I possibly can in my power to make sure these players can, at the collegiate level, can monetize their name, image, and likeness. If that happens, then I'm cool. I'm not cool with it, but I can live with what happened.
Right.
So that's my main focus. Obviously, on the business side, I want to make sure that I can grow my businesses and essentially be a entertainment conglomerate. And then on my foundation that I have, I'm gonna do as much as I can to help with criminal justice reform. And also, you know, my passion project right now is to try to get these roots changed. So that's my future. That's what I'm going to be fighting for every day, and that's what I'm doing every day. And my partners and everybody else who's working with us, that's our main focus.
Well, we appreciate you, man. And
we have no doubt that you will accomplish all of that.
Absolutely.
God bless
you. I love it, love brother. It, thank Listen, you so brother, much for taking the time.
Yeah, we Definitely appreciate you, man. Looking
forward to speaking further.
I appreciate you, too. If you need anything in the future, just let me know.
Sounds Absolutely, good, brother. Thank you.